very long passage, continuous passage, where most of it actually is Jesus talking. Now, I'm just curious. How many of you here have heard of the Sermon on the Mount? Okay. So a lot of you have, but some of you haven't. So this is kind of a good introduction. And so today we're actually going to do a little bit of an introduction to the Sermon on the Mount. And I wanted, before to go into it, I wanted to say something. So it's this idea Jesus is bringing a plan, a purpose, he's painting a picture of a new kingdom. He says this thing early in the New Testament, in the Gospel of Matthew. He says, you know what? Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven. And before him, John the Baptist, who came, also said the same thing. He said, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And so what I want you to think about is that Jesus is bringing and ushering in and introducing something new, something radical, something very different, something that you've never seen before or they never had at that time. And I think it is also meant to be something to challenge the way we look at the world today. It's meant to be something that kind of subverts what we understand of reality and how we are to face the world. So it's kind of an idea of how are we to live in light of knowing this teaching from Jesus? How are we to live in knowing in light of this Jesus? And so I'm going to start with a personal story. And I think when you go to the Sermon on the Mount, you have to share personally. And so specifically today, a lot of the stories are going to be more personal because this is the reason why we're doing Sermon on the Mount. Partially, it's I think it has a very profound effect on people. I feel like, Ian, you're going to burn alive sitting there in the sun. Just FYI, I don't know. Just but the question I want to throw out is a really random question. Have you ever met someone or experienced something that completely transformed your life? Maybe or your perspective, something that you encountered, a person, a class you might have taken, a person, a conversation, a book you read, something that greatly affected you personally. Anybody here, has you ever had that? There's probably multiple different moments in your life that's happened, right? I'm guessing. A few examples. You might have got a job that you really loved and it allowed you to do something you really wanted to do. It could be a relationship with someone that becomes perhaps your wife, right? That person greatly alters your life and your experience. It could be the fact that you got married and your marriage is something that's profoundly shaped you. It could be that you had children. Having children is a huge life change thing. It changes the way you look at everything, right? It could be maybe a conversation you had, maybe a class you took at UC Santa Barbara or somewhere else, or it could have been a book you read, right? Do you have something like that in your life that has profoundly shaped you? And my hope today is that like these experiences that you've ever had that have greatly challenged your faith, that have greatly challenged your thinking, that have greatly formed you, that as we start this series in the Sermon on the Mount, it would do the same thing for you as well. I think for me, the reason why particularly this is important is because, before I go to the next slide, is that the Sermon on the Mount itself, this piece, these three chapters, continues to change my life and challenge my life since I first read it. And since I started studying it, like maybe 15 years ago. And I think two people that kind of know that, there's a lot of people that kind of know it, but the particular ones that really know it, I think, are the Yuens, the Yis, and the Lins. Because they have walked with us for a season, and I walked with me for a season, and we've read the Sermon on the Mount. We've studied the book itself together, one of the books we read together. And my story starts with this, my friend, Dian. My buddy Dian. This is a picture from my other friend's wedding, the other part, D in our crew, Dennis. And this is me with my buddy Dian. He's actually doing his PhD. He's almost done at a seminary in Dallas. And Dian is one of my good friends. He's also one of my nemesis, jokingly. We're like best friends. And we love to study together, but it's always competitive. There's never a moment where we're not kind of competing. We took a class at City College just to see who could get a better grade. We just took the whole class. And then the whole time, we're just fighting. Like, who could get the better test, better quiz grades? I think I won. I think we both got A's, but I think I got a higher final grade. So I think I won that one. But we always compete. And this Dian early on was one of the first people to really show me the passion for walking with Jesus. And he went to Calvary Chapel. And he was at Calvary Chapel. This is a church that is down further down south in Santa Barbara. And he went and he was like, man, you know, I want to read something new. And Dian, like always, doesn't really plan things. It makes him like really annoying sometimes. He walks into the bookstore and then he sees this first book and he goes, oh, sure, I'll read this book. He grabs the book and it's this book called Studies in the Sermon on the Mount by Martin Lloyd-Jones. And then Deanna was like, I'm reading this book. It's pretty good. And then like, I'm like, well, shoot, if he's reading it, it must be pretty good. So I'm going to read it. So it started this journey of competition between us two. And I'm not really talking about Deanna. I'm talking about the book. But Lloyd-Jones, this book, had a very profound effect on me personally. And the reason why is because this book, before I read this book, I was going to church, attending regularly, and was worshiping God. And I was like, hey, I really love Jesus. I really think Christian faith is a big thing. It's my life. It's important. And then when I read this book by Lloyd-Jones, it kind of like opened my eyes to the fact that my life in its fullness did not reflect Christian faith and my belief in Jesus. And because of that, it really challenged me that I needed to do more in my life, that I needed to see God in everything in my life. And in that sense, it started me on a journey of walking with Jesus deeper and deeper. And it kind of opened my eyes to the idea that your imagination can be awakened to walking with Jesus. And so it what happened for me personally was when, you know, you guys talk to me, I tend to be like kind of like, I can be negative and harsh and sometimes, but I tend to look at my faith as something very life-giving, very adventurous. And I think it started with this book that it was unexpected, out of nowhere, and it profoundly shaped my life. And it still shapes my life. And today is really kind of an introduction to that idea of why it's so profound, how it can profoundly affect all of us, and how important it is. And I wrote this down because I really think it's a good way to look at it, is often when you hear the gospel, you go, oh, you know what? I heard the gospel once. My life has changed. Therefore, I'm a Christian, right? And it's a momentary commitment. And when you think, often people think of Christian faith as like, oh, I made an acknowledgement to Jesus once in my life. And that means I'm always a Christian. And I think that's true. But I think what the gospel, the Sermon on the Mount taught me was that following Jesus is not just a momentary commitment. It's a lifelong obedience in the same direction. And that's from a book I read. But it's like the quote, but a lifelong obedience in the same direction as Jesus. It's a constantly, every day, you find new ways to worship him. You find new ways to fall in love with him. And you find new ways to honor him and live for him. And every day we fail. Every day we fail. But it's a lifelong, continuous trust of walking in that faith. And because of that, that's why our title, I don't know, you saw my title. It's called #blessed. Now, it's kind of a name that just came out of nowhere, but it's not really. It's the fact that I want us to recapture this idea of blessedness, that we think of blessedness as being something that's, you know, it's always the good things, right? And I think it is the good things. But yet I want us to recapture it in the idea of what does it mean to really be blessed? And I think Sermon on the Mount kind of paints the picture of what it looks like. So before I start, let me just read us the text. Okay, we're going to just read 10 verses from Matthew. If you have your phone Bible, totally cool. Matthew 5, it's in the New Testament, the very first book of the New Testament. So it's about two-thirds of the way book through the book. You look at the first thing that has like a stopgap from Malachi to Matthew. Matthew, we're going to be in the fifth chapter, first 10 verses, 1 through 10. And last time we talked, we were Matthew 4. So we're just kind of jumping right into the next section. Tell me when you're ready. Matthew 5, verses 1 to 10. I'm going to read it, okay? Seeing the crowds, Jesus, went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And then he opened his mouth, and he taught them, saying these words, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And blessed those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And then I'll just go to verse 11. "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you, falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." And so this is the Beatitudes. This is what we know as, or I call them nicknames. I'm too lazy to type it all always out. Because I always get when you're typing, it always autocorrects to something else. Mine autocorrects to the beats. For some reason, I'm always like, beats. So I just call it the beats. So it's the beats. And so let's pray and we'll get started. Father, how wonderful is this text? How beautiful are your words and how amazing you are, Father. And thank you so much for this chance. I think it's one of those things I'm grateful for this text that has profoundly shaped my life. And I pray, Father, that today it would start to change the lives of the community here with me. It would shape my brothers and sisters' lives, my friends' lives here. Lord, it's a text that I'm really scared to share because I don't think I'll do it justice because there's so many great men and even women that have come before that have taught this text so much better. And I just pray that you would really bless the time we have together studying this text. May you be glorified through it. May you challenge us to see our lives differently and open our eyes and our hearts to who you are, what you've been doing, and how you will continue to shape us through this lifelong obedience in the same direction. So thank you, Lord, for this time in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. And I think when you read today, we're going to kind of do an overview. And the reason we're going to do an overview is because I think in order to kind of look at each verse of the Beatitudes, you have to kind of see how it looks as a whole. It's easy to kind of look at individual pieces and lose the context of what's going on. And so hopefully today, kind of as we overview the text, we're going to kind of travel through it and see it together and see how God is painting a picture of something greater. It's like if you listen to a song, you know how when you listen to a song, you sample pieces like Apple Music? Usually when you listen to a song, it gives you like, I don't know how many seconds does it give you, 15 seconds, 30 seconds of a song? And you're like, oh, it's pretty good. But you don't know the whole song, right? And it's like when you're looking at the Beatitudes, you're only looking at pieces of a song. But to see the whole symphony, to see the whole, the complexity of the song, you have to kind of look at the whole text. So my encouragement to you as we study it is that you would go back and you would read the Beatitudes. You would study the Beatitudes and kind of look over it and kind of explore how it grows you. And today we're going to kind of give you an overview of the whole thing so you can kind of start to read it yourself personally and see how it can challenge your life. And so my sermon today is called #blessed, that's the series name, the Beatitudes. And it's my first 3 points is the idea of blessing, curse, and hope. Blessing, curse, and hope. So we're going to follow this theme of blessing, curse, and hope. And let me just start with blessing. I think often the idea of tying to blessing is good things, right? When you hear blessing, what do you hear? What do you think of? You think of happiness. You think, no, I'm happy. I'm blessed, right? And people say in music, a lot of recent music is like #blessed, you know? Song is good. Your life is good. #blessed. And I think that's an understanding that I think is pretty accurate. Blessing is tied to happiness. And when you read the word blessed here, you can actually use the word happy in its place. It's in its original language. It has the idea of favor and blessing, okay? But I think in our world, we tend to say, we use blessed in a different way. We go to your happy place, right? Go to your blessed place. Go to your happy place, right? You go to this place where you're avoiding things. And then the other idea is like we say, some people love to go to your happiest place on earth, which is Disneyland, right? And when you go to Disneyland, you don't have to think about things. You just enjoy the experience of Mickey Mouse and his friends, right? And it's great. And I'm not criticizing that, okay? But I think the idea of blessing in our world today is an idea that has kind of been a little bit tied to the wrong perspective. It's tied just to success. It's often tied to affluence. It's tied to material good, like the abundance, having a lot. And I think when we say someone's blessed, what do we say? You had a great marriage. You have a good marriage. Oh, you have great kids. Your family's healthy. You have a great paying job, right? You have a great paying job. That means you must be blessed. You have a nice car. Oh, you must be blessed. You have a successful career. You're blessed. You've been blessed with a great body, right? You're blessed. Everything is around vibrancy and life and like abundance and power and like strength. And I think there's just an inordinate focus on that affluence focus in blessed. And I think when you read it in the New Testament and you read it in the Old Testament, when you read the Bible and you see the idea of blessed, the idea of blessed kind of means good things, but it also means the idea of being satisfied, to be fully satisfied, to receive God's favor regardless of circumstance. It's that idea that you're blessed because you understand how God is working in your experience, in your life. And so that kind of leads me to this idea then, which I want us to think about, is what does it mean to be blessed? What does it mean to live a life of blessedness? What does it mean to be blessed, right? And I think the Sermon on the Mount, what it does is it kind of Jesus, for 3 chapters, he starts to paint a picture of the life of a blessed person. That this is what it looks like to live in my kingdom. That if the kingdom of heaven is at hand, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to follow me. This is the way it looks like to live for me. And this is the way it looks like to honor me in everything you say and do and how you think. And so today, I kind of want us to do an overview of the entire Sermon on the Mount. So we're going to run through it aggressively. Okay? I have 3 main ideas, but it's going to break into small pieces. And we're just going to kind of like stumble our way through and face plant in every piece because it would be kind of nice to face plant in every piece. But we're going to look at each part and look how kingdom living looks according to what Jesus says. Because Jesus' words to me mean more than I like what you guys all say. But if you want to see, Jesus' words really, really are something else. So The first thing I think we start to look at is, what does it mean to live like this? Is this idea of engaging the world. Can you go to the next point? My first point is how we interact or engage or have relationship with the people around us. And what Jesus does after he kind of goes to the Beatitudes, which we're going to come back to, is he starts to talk about how we're to look. And the first thing he says, and I'm kind of doing this really cursory, is he talks about us. We are called to be salt and life. And this is like salt and light. This is like verses 13 to 16. So if you're reading and you're following scripture, chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, the idea of salt and light. You guys don't remember what salt is. Salt brings flavor. I can't taste flavor right now, so it's horrible. My life feels colorless. Totally appeals to me understanding this thing, right? And you spit it out if it doesn't taste good. So I don't feel like eating, so it's kind of a crazy season. But the idea of salt and light is this idea of that you are called to be something that is a preservative. You are called to have a role in this world's, preventing this world's decay. Because salt, what it did at that time, wasn't just to give flavor. It was actually more, salt things was to create preservation. So the meats wouldn't rot, things wouldn't go bad. You would use salt to make things dry up, so it tastes better later. You can have it for longer. So the idea was to prevent decay. And if I know you guys know physics. Some of you guys are physics guys. Who's physics guys here? Anybody physics? Oh, yeah, you're by myself. But the idea if it is like there's that where everything in the world is breaking down, right? Isn't that a law of thermodynamics? I'm horrible at physics, right? One of the laws of thermodynamics? Yeah, atrophy, right? And the world is breaking down. And in this verse, Jesus says, we as salt, we are a part of reconciling. We are a part of maintaining. We are a part of preservation, preventing decay. And that means, in many ways, as Christians, we are called to influence this world as preservation. And that looks like what it means that we are called to go into places and build up. We're not called to be, just sit in our place, right? Salt in a salt shaker does not offer any preservation or flavor. Only way salt has flavor and helps things is that you put it into things. You mix it into things. Not just one little grain of salt. You need a lot of salt, right? And in the same way, we are called to be salt and life in our lives. How we engage the world is we are called to build up. We are to fill spaces. So when we see things that are decaying, that are breaking down in this world, when there's brokenness in this world, I really do believe Jesus right here says, you are called to be salt and life as a witness of his glory, of what the kingdom looks like by entering those spaces and preserving it and showing a different way to do things. Okay. So the first thing he says is we're to be salt and light. We're to be a preservative. And then he talks about anger. Why anger? He says, don't murder people. You've heard it said that you shall not murder, right? And all these things. And the idea here, I want you guys to see, he's saying is, and we're going to go into these more deeply in the future, so I just really want to casually cover it. It's the idea that, you know what? Don't be angry. Don't be angry at your friends. Don't be disdaining. Don't look down at people, right? If your motives, your heart is wrong, your feelings are wrong, then everything you do is going to be affected by it. It will shape everything else you do. And so if you really follow Jesus, if you truly care about people around you, then you always want to see them as who God has made them, that God has made them precious. And you know, we are called then to reconcile with them. We're not called just to cast away our anger at a friend. We're called to reconcile with them, to seek their good, and to make disciples of them by restoring those relationships. And so the second thing he says is the way you deal with anger is you restore relationships that are broken. You don't use anger. You don't, because anger leads to darkness, to murder, to hurting people. But he says, instead of that, go the other way. Restore relationships. Reconcile. You have a brother that's angry at you, restore with them. And then the third thing he says then is not just your relationship with the world when things are wrong, not just when you have anger. He says, you know what? In your relationships with people, intimate relationships with people, in your relationships with people that you care about the most, whether it's your wife or your husband, that we are to have a wholesomeness to our relationship with people. What does that mean to have a wholesomeness? It means that you don't just give yourselves physically to a person. You don't just give your body to someone. You says, God, I think God has a bigger picture for a relationship. He says, what he wants is you to give your heart, your mind, your soul. Everything should connect with that person, not just a physical sharing of pleasure, right? That there is more to relationship than just a half relationship. That it takes everything. And he desires us to have full relationships with people, okay? And then he goes, right after that, he goes, but not just that you have intimate relationships that are full, for people you care about, that you love them, but you love them genuinely with everything you have. He says, no, not just that, but the way you speak, the way you make promises with people, that those need to be wholesome. That everything you say, you can't half say something. You need to fully say something. Say yes, then mean it. Say no, mean it. be truthful. Always have things that are better for people. Improve the conditions around you. Make things better, right? Your words should matter. It has weight. And then we'll come back to these things. And then later on, he says then, when you are being attacked, when you are being persecuted, when violence is happening towards you, how are you to respond? How are you to respond when there's injustice in your life? Well, you're to turn your other cheek. You're to expose yourself to them. You're supposed to love them. You're supposed to pray for them. What he's saying is this, that you would win them over with a different way of doing things. That if the natural way of the world is to reciprocate violence with violence, what do? You pray for them. You go to God on their behalf. You love them fully. And it says here, right, you win them with a different ethic. You conquer with not power, not with violence, but with love, with grace. And so that's just all interacting. And I'm totally going to butcher this breakdown because I'm not very good at breaking things down. But the second thing that he kind of says is then, how are we to honor God in our lives? How are we to worship him and honor him in our lives? And the first thing he says is how we serve the poor. How do we serve the poor? Don't tell your left hand what your right hand is doing. And what he's saying here, he's saying is don't tell yourself. Don't get yourself focused in the situation. Why? Because we often do things for all the wrong reasons. That you're really not doing it always out of genuine love or concern. Sometimes you're sitting in the car, you're driving, you pull up to the stoplight, and you're like, oh my goodness, homeless dude, asking for money, don't got that much. And then you're like rolling your windows, like, oh, please don't talk to me, don't look at me, right? We don't really want to, or we help them. We're going, you know what, today I fit my quota of loving a person. I gave him a quarter, right? Or that sounds really lame, but I'm just saying, we our habit is we show concern or genuine love for people. But it's not really because we do. We do it kind of because we want people to see us a certain way. So we might give money to people because they're like, oh, maybe someone sees me and thinks I'm really genuine. But and especially for ourselves, we do it for ourselves. We do it so what? So that we look better. We feel good, right? It's all self-focused. And that's why he says here, don't let your left hand and your right hand know what it's doing. Don't be aware of it. Don't focus on you when you're doing these things. But then he doesn't stop there. Then he says, how about your prayer? How about your fasting life? And it says here in chapter 6, verse 6, it says, when you pray, go into your room, shut the door, pray to your Father who is in secret, who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. And the idea here is, are you truly praying and seeking God, or are you doing it for your glory or for yourself? Because what happens when you're praying is often the people are praying, they're like, look at me, I've got the best prayers, I've got the most coolest fasting, I'm doing the right things, I'm serving the poor. And it's focused on you, but not really on God. And he says, go to the privacy of your room where nobody can see you and spend time with God. Focus on him only. And that leads me to a question. And this is the question I think he poses here is, what happens when you're by yourself? Where do your thoughts go? Do they go to God? Or do they go to the newest thing that you're really interested in, like shoes or phone or video game or toys or card or a person? Or is it genuinely focused on God? Because whatever you are thinking in those private moments, whatever you're praying to, that's what you really worship. That's where your heart really is focused on. And I hate to say that because that's scary and that is really humbling because I'm not always thinking about Jesus, right? Okay, so that's the idea. You're praying, even your fasting life needs to be wholesome. It needs to be focused on him. And then he goes, but not just this, but how you worship me also works on how you look at things around you that could tempt you. How about the money in your life, the treasures that you put your values in? And I got this one from a sermon I really liked, and it basically said is, what do you spend money on with the least effort? Okay, that was the question the person posted. He said, whatever you spend money on that takes no blinking of an eye, you just swipe the credit card. Whatever that is, is probably what you value the most, okay, that you can do comfortably, and you're probably not doing it for God. It might be for yourself, it might be for others, but it really shows you what you truly care about. So, for example, we're just talking, but like we buy stuff, right? We buy stuff we love. If there's no even willingness to consider that these things might be, we're over interested in just casually spending money, we might not have a good perspective. It might not be full, healthy, right? And that's a hard question. And basically what he's saying here is, do you put God before your money, your wealth, your treasures that you can possess here? Does God come first? Do you value that relationship more? Or do you worship those things too? Okay? And so my second point, of course, is in how we worship and honor God, even those things can be, he calls us to live it blessed, okay, in a fuller way for God. And then lastly, he goes, then how do we deal and how do we approach the ups and downs of our lives, the struggles of our lives? How do we deal with all these things? And I think the first thing is this idea of circumstance. Like, don't be anxious. Wherever you eat, whatever you wear, wherever you go, whatever happens to you, you have confidence in God. Do you worry or anxious? Are you anxious all the time? Are you a person that struggles with anxiety or worry? Okay, I'm not directing this at anybody, okay? And the idea is this. When you have anxiety and you worry, what you're really saying, and I don't usually say this directly, but I'm going to say it, is that you don't trust God. Basically, what you're saying is you don't trust God. Because what you're saying is, you know what? I think I know what's best for my life. And when it doesn't align with my perspective, what's good for life, when God doesn't do what I expect, okay, then maybe he doesn't have my best interest in it. And then I'm worried now because I'm going, oh, I don't know, man. Things are maybe not in his control, you know? And as I'm saying, I'm kind of being a little downer on it, but it's not like intentional sometimes. We just are scared, right? We're scared, we're anxious because I would say we haven't learned to let it go to God. We haven't seen his sovereignty in that space. And you think that you know what life ought to go. And so you're going, I think I know what's best for me, God. And is that really trusting that God really has your best in mind? And I think what that really shows is that we still have a little pride in our hearts. We still have a little belief that we know what's best for ourselves and God doesn't know what's best for us. And I think what he's saying here is, do you trust me? Will you not be anxious? He says at the very end, don't be anxious about tomorrow, for even tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Focus on what you can control in front of you. God is in control ultimately, but you can still honor me and do what you can, but stay in the present. Don't overspend time. Now, that point really spoke to me because when I was younger, I was always worried about the future. And then what God did with that was that he said, you know, when you spend all this time worrying about tomorrow, you're doing that today. So you're actually wasting all this time today worrying about tomorrow. And you're like, man, yeah, that's such a waste of time. Why should I be doing that? And I think what he's saying here is, do you see that I'm absolutely in this time too? That even in your circumstances, whatever you face, I'm still there. And I'm controlling it. I'm taking care of you. And the last thing is, when we disagree with people, when we have problems with people, that's often the two areas that we have most problem when we approach life struggles, right? We have problems with whatever's happening in our lives or the people in our lives, right? Our natural tendency when we see someone do something, we disagree with them, or we think they're absolutely wrong, is the first thing we do is we judge them, okay? I want you to understand here, this is not saying you can't critique someone. You can't say, maybe you could do something better. But I think the idea of judgment is to say, you know what? You're wrong, and because of it, you don't deserve God. You don't know God. You don't love God. And you basically are condemning them in a divine sense, in an eternal sense. It's not a temporal sense, right? And when we do that, that doesn't honor God at all. And what he says here is, are you seeking a deep care for them? Do you genuinely care about them enough to build them up, to want to see them, and to respond to them and critique them even with grace or love, with humility? And are you building them up? Do you want their best? And so I just kind of ran through this thing, but do you see? The Sermon on Mount, what it paints is this life that you're supposed to live, a life that I think it desires you to be whole, to have relationships that are really rich, to want the best in this world, to see the world in a better way, to help this world in a better way, to not be selfish, not to be self-centered, not to be stingy with things, but to be generous, to not be bitter, right? To be faithful, to love people well, right? It's beautiful. It's so beautiful. It makes you bright. When you enter spaces with people, it affects people because you're a salt. You're a light. You affect for good. You see that? And that's, I think, why the idea of the Sermon on the Mount is such a blessing. Why I use the hashtag blessed, because the SOM, or sorry, Sermon on the Mount, it really paints a picture of what I think life is meant to look like. Okay? And then this takes me to curse. Why is it a curse? And don't worry, the last 2 points will be fast because I just realized I'm running out of time. Curse. Why is it a curse? Here's the reason why I keep revisiting this text, okay? Because it shows me how I truly want to live in Christ. I come to this text because I come to this text at least once every few weeks and I read it through. And if you ever have talked to me, you've ever studied with me, you ever talked to me about theology or faith, I probably got some wisdom from this text. Like, when people ask me, what should I do about non-Christian girlfriends or boyfriends or something? And I'll use this text to kind of wrestle with it. What should I do about this person I don't like? Loving your enemies, you know? What should I do about money? Well, do not be anxious. Do not store up treasures in heaven. You know, I tend to apply a lot of this into my relationships with you guys in ministry. But here's the reason why I see it as a curse, okay? Is that it's a curse because when I read this, every week I fail. Every day I fail at this. When I read this text, it says, be salt and life. And I'm like, salt and light. I'm like, well, I wasn't really salty yesterday. I saw a problem and I was like, nope, not dealing with that. Close my windows and drive away. Don't get angry. I'm like, I'm still pretty mad at someone in our church right now. I haven't sought to reconcile with them. I'm totally failing that. Lust, we see people, beautiful people, and we struggle with our eyes. All of us do, right? Not always, but we try not to, but we do, right? And then we make oaths. Oaths, that's a hard one, but sometimes we go, you know what? I'm going to do this. Or you say something you don't mean, right? I do that every day, right? When I joke around too much. And then you know what? There's a retaliation, loving your enemies. I don't really have many enemies in my life, except for people that cut me off. When I'm driving, it can be really horrible, right? So I'm like, I'm definitely not loving my enemies. I'm definitely not praying for them, right? If they cut me off, I'm probably going to give them a thumbs up or cut them off again or get really satisfied when I get in front of them somehow, right? I'm not honoring God. And when I do things for other people, sometimes I'm not doing it for him. When I'm praying, am I really praying? And the way I spend money, do I spend it genuinely on the things? Or casually spend it too quickly? Or do I judge certain people here so much before I even really love them and seek their best? Am I anxious about my future? You see, on a personal level, when I read this, every moment I read it, it crushes me because it feels like I can't do it. I can't honor it. I fail. And I wonder, do you feel that way? Because when you read this text, I think the same way. You should think this way. Because there's two things it says here that's really challenging to me. Verse 20 of chapter 5, he says, I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. He says, the most religiously elite people, you need to be more awesome than they are and faithful. I'm no John Piper, you know? I'm no saint, and I fail. And then the other thing it says is then, later on in verse 48, you therefore must be mature, complete, perfect, as your heavenly Father is mature and complete and perfect. And you're like, well, definitely that's not happening. It crushes you because you go, I'm far from all these things. I fall very short. And I think when I was reading Lloyd-Jones, I think that's the one thing he showed me was that I can't live this. As excellent as the demand is and as much as I want to daily practice it, every day I fail. And I come and there's crushing discouragement from that. Okay. But then is that where God stops? No, he doesn't stop there because when you read the Beatitudes, whether you think there's 8 or 9 or 10 of them, okay, it's really telling you a people that have been changed. It's saying, blessed are those who are like this, because theirs is the kingdom of heaven, right? And the idea is, this is who you can be. This is who we are called to be. But it's hard. And so what is the hope? How can we become that? And I think the common thing is we think of it as just a standard of rules to do. So when you read the Sermon on the Mount, you go, oh, you know what? I just need to do these things. If I check off these things, I'm a good person. I'm pretty faithful. I've done all the right things. But I want you to understand here, it says the word blessed at first. Why blessed comes before everything? It's really important. Because blessed, it means, you know what? This was given to them. This wasn't something they achieved on their own. Something was given to them freely. Blessed. And it says here that in the very first one and then the very last one of the Beatitudes, you look at it, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And it says at the very end, blessed are those who persecute for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And it says, blessed are those, this is what you get, the kingdom of heaven. We're part of something greater when you're part of this thing, okay? But how is that possible? How are we part of this? And I was going to cover the first verse Beatitudes this week, and I totally just like nuked it at the very end because I really wanted to cover everything that I painted for you. But I'm just going to show you the first beatitude. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's not talking about poor like you're financially just poor. It's talking about poorness in a sense that you understand you are absolutely at your wit's end. You have no more to offer this world. That you are helpless. That's what it means to poor in spirit. Okay? And when it says that, I want you to understand, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's a present tense statement. It says, this is what you have. When you truly have this mindset, this is the fact. You have the kingdom of heaven. And what I think that means is kind of tied to this idea that if you ever heard, and you guys, it's not a funny thing, but have you ever heard like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, right? You've heard of like any of those Narcotics Anonymous, all those things that have those things. The first model they say is what? I don't have a complete right, but we admit we are powerless. We are powerless over whatever substance we have that we're talking about, that our lives have become unmanageable. The only way you know you need grace, you need this gospel, you need to know blessedness, is you need to first know that you cannot do it yourself. You are at your very wit's end. That's the poor in spirit mindset. The only time you'll ever get this is when you understand that. And then it says, blessed are those who mourn. Do you have a heart of mourning for the world around you? Do you have a position, a posture of meekness? And then it says, do you hunger and thirst for righteousness? Which Chris and I really love this verse. We always talk about it. We always pray it in our verses. Do you hunger and thirst? You know what hunger and thirst means? Like, I'm not talking about like you hungering, thirsting, like, oh, you have a belly ache from not having breakfast this morning. This is as though you're starving. You haven't had food. You've been walking in the desert for days, and then you see water and food, and you just run up to it, and you just want to, like, stick it down your throat as fast as possible. That desperateness, right? Hungering and thirsting for that righteousness. Do you want righteousness with that desperation? And I think when you start to understand this text, what I want you to see is that what he's saying here is we need something more. And the only way you have this, the question is, how did this happen? And the idea of blessedness, I just read this recently, really cool. The idea of blessedness in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, it means favor, right? To have favor, to be happy. But in the Old Testament, what did it mean to be blessed? Who were the people that were blessed in the Old Testament? They were the heroes. They were the people that were bringing good things to the world. They were changing things for the Jewish people, right? And when it says blessed here, I want you to see it's looking and pointing to someone else. It's saying that in order to become blessed, something has to happen to change your life to have this. What is that? How does that happen, right? And when you read this text, I think what you see in the Beatitudes, let me read it again to you. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they shall be satisfied. And blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And what I want you to see is that the Beatitudes describes Jesus. Jesus accomplished this so that we can have it. The reason we can have blessing today is because Jesus became the curse. Do you see that? He is a hero unlike anybody else. It says here, he is poor in spirit. Jesus was poor in spirit. He was humble. He didn't grasp for the things of God, right? He was humbled. He served us. He was poor physically, but he was also poor in heart. He was posturous. He was mourning. He mourned for Jerusalem. He mourned for the people. His heart broke for them. He was meek. He didn't go and like, oh, I'm the best, right? He didn't say that. He hungered and thirsted for righteousness. He even says at the very end of his life, I thirst, right? He says, I thirst, right? Blessed are the merciful. Who is most merciful? What did Jesus do for us? How about the pure in heart? Who is the most purest? And I think when you see the word pure in heart here, it's the idea of focus. His focus was so focused on purpose, on getting it done, to achieve that purity, right? To honor him, to honor God in living his life. And also, the idea of peacemaker, to make peace. I want you to see, this is the unlikely hero that achieves blessedness for us. The reason we are blessed today, okay, that we have the ability to live this life, is because Jesus became that for us. He first did it for us. When I look at this text, I feel very discouraged. Because I go, I can't do this. I can't live this life. I'm not good enough, God. And then at the moment I start feeling the curse of it, then I look at the words blessed and I realize Jesus already did it for me. Because Jesus has accomplished it for me and you, for all of us. We never have to be good enough. In God's eyes, we are good enough. We are loved. And therefore, we can live this life out in worship to him. That's why we're blessed. We didn't do anything to deserve this. You understand? This is why I try to love you guys. And I'm horrible at it. I'm horrible at loving because I'm impatient. I was talking to a brother recently, and he was like, man, you're just sometimes too direct. I was like, you're probably right, right? And so I'm finishing. I got to finish up now. So this text, I just want you guys to think about it as, what does it mean to be blessed? And I want you to think about how much Jesus has done. See, the thing that's really cool about this is the Beatitudes. It just blows me away because I realize Jesus, he did all those things first for us. And so we could have him. So let's pray.